the bottom line for us is just like, how are we actually making it so that what we're building is like giving people more power to decide how they want their money used in the social good space? How are we ultimately making sure that those people who have a dollar, their dollar is as impactful and as effective as someone who has $1 billion to put in?
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. It was good to have the chance to talk to Brendan Lind. Brendan is currently founder of Human Agency, a firm that's working to democratize advertising. What does that mean? That means providing tools and consulting, connecting advertising on the big internet platforms with user-defined content and crowdfunding of ads. Brendan was previously co-founder and founding executive director of a nonprofit called LaunchCode, an organization that provides pathways to upward mobility through paid apprenticeships and other tech jobs and training, and which he helped grow to over $6 million budget and attention from the Obama White House. Brendan has quite the story of entrepreneurship, and he's well worth your listen. So, a quick word from our sponsor, then my interview with Brendan Lind at Human Agency.
This episode is brought to you by Graphicacy. Graphicacy is an analytic design firm that can help you advance the mission of your organization using your own real data and information. They are 21st century visual communicators who create interactive graphics, motion graphics, and data visualizations. You can find Graphicacy at graphicacy.com. That is GRAPHICACY.com. With Graphicacy's help, you can visualize a better world.
So, Brendan, would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Yeah. Hey, I'm Brendan Lind. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Human Agency. And background, pretty simple. Grew up in Idaho, northern Idaho, one of the most conservative states in the union. Went to Missouri for school. And after school, I co-founded a nonprofit that helps people get jobs in tech.
What was this nonprofit called?
It's called LaunchCode. So we started a nonprofit called LaunchCode. Really started to kind of make tech more inclusive. So most people get jobs because of who they know, where they've worked, college degree, right? Some form of privilege. And there's a lot of people who could, in theory, get jobs if they just don't know the right people. So we got a bunch of companies to agree to hire people who we would refer and recommend who didn't have kind of your traditional like credentials, right? Or networks. And so we got a bunch of companies on board that like got a bunch of free media, got thousands of people to apply and put people in these apprenticeships. They resulted in permanent full-time jobs. And then it was like, we had some issues. The core issue was like, even though we were trying to help people, 6% of our applicants were women, 8% were people of color, right? So all of a sudden, like—
almost as if the country was 6% female.
Totally, which— from my understanding is not the case. There's the substance of what we're offering, kind of, but there's also just like, who is what we're doing speaking to? And so then we kind of did a couple things, but one was like, we started partnering to like offer free coding boot camps. So we created these free coding boot camps that would be 6 months, kind of what normally costs $20,000, we just started offering for free. And we just started running a ton of digital ads. We took stories of people who we'd helped that kind of, you know, Kathy, a mom who had been out of work for 5 years because she had a kid and decided to get back in the workforce and no one would consider a resume, but she was super talented. We took Kathy's story, sent it to kind of women in the St. Louis region, and then we actually found that just basically through having the right message to the right people for whom they resonate, you can actually change like who decides to participate in these opportunities. So like this year, you know, it just completed, we had 60% of the people in our classes were women, 60% were people of color. And in the process, worked with the Obama White House to kind of expand the organization around the country. So now we have probably 10 plus cities that were running these free coding boot camps and thousands of people that are taking free classes a year. So kind of was doing that and kind of saw through just these kind of digital ads, right? That like, hey, it wasn't just like the substance of what we were proposing, but there was like who we're reaching and how are we communicating what we're doing. And was like, hey, could we use these things to actually advance like the stuff that we care about beyond either just jobs? And so that's kind of this kind of leads into the start of Human Agency.
Right. But just to stay on LaunchCode for a second.
Yeah, sure.
What you were saying, we, who is we with LaunchCode?
Yeah. So when we started LaunchCode, there was a number of people who started it with me. So one was this guy, Jim McKelvey, co-founder of Square, this local pizza guy who is named Chris Summers.
How did you fall in with these luminaries of various sorts?
Yeah. Well, so I always wanted to like do shit and I just want to make stuff happen. And you graduate from college and you may have your potential to do things similar to like someone we'd work with in LaunchCode. Like you have potential that exceeds like your capacity to actually make it happen in the world. Like I had no network. And so then I just kind of, there was these guys, they wanted to do something in the tech space in St. Louis. And I got myself in and was like, you guys have network and I have time.
That doesn't help me fully understand this connection. So
yeah.
So let's backtrack a tiny bit because it's pretty interesting. So what did you study in college and what was the college?
I went to WashU in St. Louis and I studied econ and anthro.
Okay. And then did you study like entrepreneurship at all?
No.
No. So, but it's in the air for people of your generation, right?
Yeah. And I mean, I wouldn't say I was always I was not a good student necessarily, but always motivated to like, just like only do things I want to do. So maybe I wouldn't turn in some assignments, but it was like, I was organizing trips to, you know, after 9/11, I was organizing the like car washes for the Red Cross or like after the hurricanes, like the trips to, you know,
so there was some kind of like activist tendencies that you had.
And, you know, in college I was like organizing like meal programs for kids and after school programs. And like, you know, I was always trying to make stuff happen. And so I actually graduated from college and I just didn't want to take a job because I just didn't want to do something I didn't really think was that cool. So I didn't. And I just did like random shit to make money while I was like exploring different ideas.
What does that mean, random shit to make money? You were driving an Uber?
Yeah. So it'd be like, I went on Craigslist and like I would go and like work with like, you know, like there'd be like on Craigslist, they'd be like, okay, meet in this alley and then you can like paint houses. And so I'd like go on Craigslist and like, picked up odd jobs. I like went to movie theaters and they would like, for screeners for movies, you could like, they would like pay you to like make sure that no one was recording it. So I would be given like a night vision monocle and just go watch movies for free. And like was supposedly making sure people weren't pirating movies,
and
whatever.
So how did your parents feel about these variety of odd jobs that you were engaged in?
I don't know. They're broadly supportive people. You know, it's like pretty nice. They're just like, well,
he'll sort it out.
He'll figure it out. I mean,
pursue the story a little further. So you're doing these odd jobs and did you come across doing these odd jobs, some of the pizza guy and how did this happen?
Yeah. So it was really like, so after school, I didn't want a job, but I convinced all my friends to stay in St. Louis. So I got them to get a house and then, so they're all there. And then there was this bike ride called like the FBC, either the Full Moon Bike Club or the Fucking Bike Club, whatever you want it to be. And so it's like on the full moon, ton of people bike through town. And so I went on this bike ride with my friend and then he worked at this like college prep program for doing like AmeriCorps. And then there was a girl there and she was like worked in startups in like the startup incubator thing, this nonprofit startup thing. And I was like, I don't really care about startups in the tech scene, but she played softball and like, I like just love softball. And so I was like, can I play on your softball team? And I got in on the softball team. And then, so then I like, you know, played on this very mediocre softball team that never won a game, but was like, you know, it was fun because I just love the sport.
And what was your position?
I played shortstop because you just, it's like, you just
so
get
that
run
mean
all
you
over.
That means you can field a ground ball with, is unusual in softball at a recreational level.
Yeah, totally. but it just means you get to run. I just ran around the whole diamond trying to catch the ball. So it was very fun. And then like little little things would be like, oh, hey, you want to work on this thing? Are these people looking for this? And I was always like, I don't like these things. And I'm not
inspired. So you're pretty picky, and you'd be a little bit of a tough person to hire as an employee, I think.
Well, I've never worked for anyone.
Yeah.
So
I'm feeling some kinship here.
Yeah. And so then, yeah. So then I was like, kind of get exposed to these things. And then I like heard about, okay, here's these guys that are trying to like actually like engage with like essentially like equity and access in tech. And then, and I knew a friend of mine, one of my best friends, was actually like supposed to like help one of them out from like a personal assistant level. And so she like, but then she was moving to Denver in 2 weeks. And so she started doing it. And I was like, yo, I can actually like get me in there, because I can actually like leverage this to like make cool shit happen. And so then I like went and got an intro and was like, hey, let's go make this happen. And so then,
so I'm not clear what at this stage you're making happen. It's not.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry. So I got this guy, Jim. I went, and he was the Square co-founder. He also had a glass factory. So I went and met with him at his glass factory. And
because you heard he was doing something in that nexus of area.
Tech, yeah. Space.
Yep.
And in particular, trying to get companies to decide that they would hire people that they wouldn't normally hire.
Yep.
And they like, it'd been something that was kicked around for a while, but it was like one of those things where like most people, and this was pre-Square IPO, so he didn't have like a bunch of cash at the moment, mm-hmm. you know? And it was one of those things where like everyone wants to do things where they're like, you'll pay me like a good salary and I'll do these things.
So he has a glass factory and a payment processing startup.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So regular guy.
Yeah. Regular polymath.
What was he like when you met him?
Yeah. I mean, I think just basically kind of one of those people who are like, well, if you want to do something, like go for it. Like, or like I'll generally like,
I'll be helpful.
Yeah. And like he was trying to reach these companies, and like initially when he was trying to reach these companies, just like needed like help. So for like 2 days I was like helping set up meetings for him with these companies. And then 2 days later he was just like, you can just go, you know, have these meetings and set them up. And so then it was like the first month, the goal was we wanted to get 100 companies in a month to decide that they would agree to like consider, not commit, but like consider mm-hmm. hiring people with like non-traditional tech backgrounds. And so we just did this month blitz with like Jim and Chris, the pie pizza guy, and Dan, and just like getting this little St. Louis network thing.
And this was his network sort of that he introduced you to, or you had...
Yeah. So it was like, I mean, I had no network. Idaho. But... that was real. Wow. So it was like, I mean, how he had met, basically there was this guy, Chris and Dan, and this guy, Chris Oliver, who's a coder, and they wanted to create just a boot camp. And then they met with Jim like a week before I met with Jim, and they were like, hey, let's like get people, like they were like, we want to create a boot camp. Jim's like, we should get companies to hire people they wouldn't normally hire. And then they're like, fine, you probably know better than we do. We'll get the companies first. And so then they're like, let's go get the companies. And then I just come in and I'm like, hey, like, you know, they're actually doing things on like a daily basis, that like they have jobs.
So they were happy that you were willing to put some sweat equity into this situation.
Totally. And like, you know, most people want to get paid and want jobs and things. And I'm just like, well, if you make something cool, it will ultimately like enable you to like survive. And I don't. Not motivated to go do something because it pays me first. And I'd rather like do something I believe in and get it to where I can live on it.
So at what point did they say, all right, you're the boss of this?
It was very much just organic volunteer based mm-hmm. thing where I was like the person working on it all the time. And so after a month we got 100 companies, then we're like, let's get some people. We got a couple thousand people. So at that point I had my friend Zach, who studied philosophy in college and was also like kind of unemployed. and just like kind of what do I do? So I was like, we had to like interview people. So I had to go figure out how do you like actually assess whether someone has like the potential to do these jobs in tech, not just like the right resume. So we like built out an interview process, and then I needed help. So then he and I basically moved into a building that was like, we created an office that Jim had, like this building that was about to be destroyed because somebody was buying it to like build a condominium. And so we like got to take over this building till it was going to be destroyed. this floor of a building to like turn into our office. And so then we were like sleeping on the floor, and then we would interview people from 6 a.m. to like 9 p.m. at night. 15-minute interviews nonstop.
These are
like,
job seekers.
These are job seekers, yeah. And being like, hey, what's your story? You know, it was funny because like...
Which you were completely unqualified to do.
Totally. I studied anthropology. I wrote a thesis in anthropology on like organic food.
Or maybe you were completely qualified because you were intelligent enough to...
Yeah.
To like hear their story and try to connect them to, and you knew what the companies were.
I think I just generally operate from a perspective of like, I don't actually have to know anything as much as figure out who knows the things. And then you like get the people to tell you how to do things.
I feel like I'm like suffused in millennial fumes right now.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sorry. It's gaseous. So we did this thing. We got the people, we put them in these apprenticeships, and then we actually partnered with Harvard. So when we realized like, hey, we need to get more people in here, then at some point it was like, okay, we were like, there's MOOCs, these massive online open courses that are offered, they're free education, but no one completed them. So we're like, fuck, we have to get people to finish these classes. So we went to Harvard and they started edX with MIT, which is this MOOC program. And so we went and we were like, hey, what if we did like a flipped classroom version of your MOOC? So we would like get a bunch of people to kind of like come together and work on this in person. And they're like, cool, let's do it. So we did Harvard CS50. It's their intro to computer science class. And so, yeah, it was like, oh, we decided to do that. This was like over a...
So you kind of piggybacked on an education system, yeah, and got people to take classes using that.
Yeah. And what's particularly cool is we had like, I like created these flyers that were like, you know, free education with Harvard. And we got 1600 people in a 2-week period of time to like sign up to take this free 6-month class with us. And so like in a short period of time, I created a downtown campus between like the library and a cathedral and a war memorial where this would happen over 6 months. And the first class happened with like 1600 people in an opera house in downtown St. Louis. And that kind of like kick-started.
How many people actually showed up for that?
For 600 people registered, about 800 of the people like showed up. Then it wildly diminished to where the point where if a MOOC regularly had like 1-4% of people completing them, we probably had like, you know, at the end of a 6-month period, 10% of our initial class probably completed this
because
thing.
It was actual work and learning and commitment
class.
Yeah,
but we had 40 volunteers,
so it was a real weed out process.
Yeah. We kind of start with like, hey, let's not like present gross assumptions of who should be allowed to participate in this class and like whatever. Let's just like let anyone, like, if you have the drive,
then they will self-select.
Then like you'll come. And if you want to keep coming, you'll keep coming. And let's not like put barriers that like block your participation.
Yeah.
And we found that just like the single biggest, like whether it was someone in one of our apprenticeship programs or one of our classes, the single biggest driver of someone's ultimate success was just their own motivation. Like how much were they trying to put into this?
Mm-hmm. How do you know that it was that factor in particular? Did you measure motivation at the outset in some way?
We had like a bunch of factors. So it'd be like, whether someone has a college degree, does it change their likelihood to succeed in one of our apprenticeships? Mm-hmm. Whether they have, like, once we put them in, if they...
And all these other factors didn't...
They, like, weren't really correlated with success.
Yeah.
But if we were like, did you, like, work extra, like, hours? Did you try to learn in the evening?
Grit.
Yeah. How much time did you put into, like, trying to learn this material? Mm-hmm. And it was really just, like, the people who showed up. And so, like, initially, if we were just, like, literally you show up to this class and you're in... Great. But then if we did something where we were like, fill out a form, tell us what you want to achieve and like create like a plan for how you're going to like show up, like then we've managed to like without like now we have thousands of people taking free coding boot camps that normally cost $20,000 if you use any of these like for-profit entities that are doing it, like any of the nonprofit ones, they're all free. And like, but now we have like 60% passage rates on these classes, largely because like,
Because you're pre-weeding out.
We're pre-weeding out, but weeding out around the... And because the core issue is just like, if you show up at class, it's kind of a shitty thing to show up one day and need to like have a class that can fit 1,000 people. And then all of a sudden you have 100 people in the class.
Right.
And instead, if you just... And then the people, your study buddies on...
So you got to raise a few barriers at the outset to get the right set of people.
And how do you raise barriers without actually building barriers that keep people who want to participate from being able to participate?
Got it. It's to me, it's... There's a certain genius to all this. And how long did you work on, launch code.
Yeah, so I did that for about 3.5 years. So from like 2013 to 2017.
Did you end up being compensated for some of that time after a while?
Yeah. It was kind of goofy. We started, it was just like ragtag. And so we weren't really an organization. We like got donated pizza from Chris. We got donated furniture here. We had donated building space. So we spent like a total of $10,000 in the first 10 months to like run this class and get a couple hundred people jobs. And like, yep. It was kind of like
proof of concept.
We paid my friend Zach $200 a week. So he didn't work in a coffee shop, mm-hmm. You know?
So when you left LaunchCode, mm-hmm. After 3.5 years, how many people were in the nonprofit? What was the budget?
Yeah. So when I left, we had, you know, about 50 full-time people, in about 6 different places with, like a $5 to $6 million a year budget and probably 50 to 100 contractors.
So it's a reasonably successful startup nonprofit. Mm-hmm. You don't see that happening too often with a story like that.
Yeah. In like 3.5 years with because you went back to funding. It was like we had $10,000 in that period of time. Like we had people with money, but like literally no one was putting money into this thing. And so like eventually, it's like Robin Carnahan used to be Secretary of State of Missouri. Mm-hmm. She set up a dinner where I went to dinner with the head of the DOL for the state of Missouri. And it was like right after Michael Brown was shot in Ferguson. And she was like, what do you guys need? And then like, I was like, yeah, we need like $5 million. And she gave us like $7 million over the next 3 years. And then Knight Foundation Miami gave us $1.5 million. Like we worked with Obama and built this tech hire initiative. And so then we got these tech hire grants around the country. And so we started getting money. Mm-hmm. And then companies actually also, if they hire people on an apprenticeship, they pay LaunchCode money. And so it really very few, like the organization now can operate like really like a business, like even though it's a nonprofit, but like it sustains now just off of companies paying the organization for people that it's helping get jobs. And that funds also the entirety of free education, which is kind of crazy. But
so what has this success meant for you? What kind of doors has that opened?
It's not totally clear to me. I mean, I think I definitely have gotten to know some people through it, but mm-hmm. I would say, I would say I'm not a networker in like a classic, like I'm not actually, I don't, in the same way that like, I don't want to do things that I don't want to do for work or whatever. I don't really talk to people just because I'm supposed to. I'm just like, I really just want to talk to people who I'm like, we have a collective problem we're trying to solve or something. And like, that's really all I get excited about is just what can we try to do together? And so I think like I've made strong relationships with people who are like kindred spirits who are like, hey, let's like try to do cool shit together. But you know, and it's like a flaw is like, I'm generally like, I'm like very much just like, what can we do together? And that shapes so many, that like shapes all my,
well, that's a kind of a higher order of networking. That's like a more authentic networking. Right?
Yeah. But I would say, yeah.
And it may be that you didn't do that out of planning, but out of compulsion or personality.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who I am.
I get that.
So I would say I know some people, but I wouldn't say I know a ton of people.
Yeah.
I would say that but I also realized through that it was like, I called the CEO of like Fortune 100 companies, Fortune 50 companies, where I would call from like a secretary and just act like I had a reason to talk to a person. So like when you want to talk to someone, people are surprisingly accessible. You know, if you really,
they actually turn out to be human beings.
Everyone is a human being,
and they work their way up
to date. So
to date, well, so speaking of human beings,
yeah,
you named your new thing Human Agency. Totally. Why'd you call it that?
Which
has a multiple meanings.
It has multiple meanings. I mean, I think I'm probably more philosophically driven than anything at the end of the day. So like to me, just my fundamental value is just like advancing human agency.
And by that sort
like
of agency,
freedom.
Yeah. Like our ability to set our own direction.
Yeah. There's like there's a philosopher and economist, Amartya Sen, and his thing was like the goal of all economic development, of all government should just be to like help people lead lives that they personally find meaningful, and to ensure that people have the choices to like
which is very compelling and not exactly how our economy is set up.
Totally. Yeah. And so to me, like the goal of like, and I don't think like, and all these things, technology, why do we build technology? To me, it's like I'm worried about human obsolescence, and I just think that the purpose of, I'd say that's my main concern in general. And so like, anyway, human agency is just a phrase that just fits my general value set.
But it also is agency in the sense of a group of people doing a service, a creative service.
Totally.
Right?
Yeah, and it was not actually, so at this point we do a couple of things, and actually being like an agency is one of them, but that's not at all something we set out to do.
So what is the sort of founding story and who's involved in it with human agency?
Yeah. So when kind of near the end of my like launch code era, I was getting like Trump was coming in, and I like was getting into like, okay, how can we do some of these digital things?
I'm gleaning that you're not pro Trump.
Yeah, not pro Trump. How can we do things to, you know, support humanity? And so I connected with folks in the Democratic Party in Missouri and was like, hey, what if we registered voters using ads? And so they're like, okay, here's money. You know, it was like one of those things where it was because of the like launch code thing, I was able to be like, we can do it. And I literally had no idea what I was doing.
But you had some confidence that you'd built one thing, you could build another.
Figure it out. So yeah. I decided we would register some voters. And so we went and like went out to register voters and used ads. So Jason Kander was Secretary of State of Missouri at the time. And technically it's illegal to register people to vote in online in Missouri. Like it's not allowed, but he made a system through which people could go to the website and you could print out the ballot or you could fill it in online. And then the Secretary of State would print it for you, and his office would physically mail it to the local Board of Elections. So,
a dumb law that you couldn't register online. Yeah.
But he made this.
And by the way, he was my first guest on this podcast.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he made the pretty brilliant like workaround that actually made online voter registration possible in Missouri for all practical purposes. And so then I basically made like a brand register in Missouri. And then ran a bunch of ads out and registered, like in a month, we registered 15,000 people. And normally when you register voters, right, you like register in areas with high Democratic indexes. So you'd be like, city of St. Louis, city of Kansas City, 600,000 people, 10% of the state. Those are the only people we're really trying to knock doors on for. And so, you know, instead like actually being like, hey, let's go and register people using ads, you can go take that 90% of the state, figure out, remove all the Republicans, remove everyone who likes Trump, and figure out how can we actually just be registering, you know, Democrats in places that we're just leaving Democrats like without even having their doors knocked. And so we registered 15,000 people in a month, which was a record.
And was this under the banner of human agency or was it?
No, this was just for fun.
Yeah.
I just did this for fun.
Yeah.
This was way pre-human agency. And we're able to register people. We're running ads to do so and did so for like less than half the cost of like putting an organization together and like managing volunteers to do canvassing. So it was like cheaper per person registered than canvassing. And so then, anyway, so I did that. And then I had like explored some things and in particular, like looked at like the 2016 cycle, like after that happened and it was like, okay, Trump raised half as much money as Hillary, but he ran a bunch more digital ads, right? He spent more on digital ads. And like every ad that he ran was shown to more people, right? Because like if on TV I have a dollar is shown, dollar of ads is shown to the same number of people. On digital, essentially just how engaging your shit is changes the price per person that you reach, right? Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so so basically he was able to get way more people.
And they were running lots of different iterations of ads, right? Ads.
Yeah. He would run 50,000 to 100,000 ads a day, variants.
Yeah.
And you can test all them, put the money into the ones that work best, and it's just a good process. Hillary, I was in California and Seattle, California, Washington State, if we want to stick at a state level, before like the election, it was like Hillary's ads were on TV. And like drove me insane. Like, why are we as Democrats like why am I a person who really has no money donating to Hillary when she's our candidate, when it's being essentially used to go raise, why are you running TV ads in these states? To build awareness so that people think you're doing something, so that people donate to you, right? That's like why you're running ads in those states.
Because you're saying these are two safe states. You don't, there's no reason to be, it's not an electoral ad really.
Totally. And you're still spending a fair amount of money putting yourself on TV here. Mm-hmm. And the primary, like there's a, you know, 70% of Hillary's spends was TV or print. And then you're still spending your money not in wise ways, right? And you have one agency, our friends at Bully Pulpit, who made all of the content, made all the distribution decisions, right? Every person in this country, essentially, they want to make a difference, right? No matter what their skill sets are, their capacities, they have one option, which is to go knock some doors, which is boring, ineffective, and like, and generally, like, from a user experience, leaves people feeling like they didn't actually, like, they just knock on a lot of doors, so there's not people there, right? Like, interacting with real human beings is powerful. Knocking on empty doors is often, like, soul-sucking a little bit. And then you have this other piece, which is, like, or you can donate money, right? And, you know, money game, and then you have no agency over where your money goes, right? And so then when you give money, it ends up being spent largely to raise more money in this, like, democratic vortex of, like, I donate money, it's used to raise more money. So my thing was, like, what if... if tons of ads, if the majority of Democratic money is ultimately used on advertising, why don't we change the process for how advertising works? One, if advertising is one part creative, one part targeting, which is like who you're reaching and what platform you're using, and another part funding, those don't all have to be controlled by the same people. You can kind of like break those out. So like a regular person who's good at making content, anybody who's good at making content, we don't have to rely on really good people at Bully Pulpit to make all the content. Like great people, like authentic communicators make the best messaging. Like the people who've broken through in this country on any issue, it's like kids in Florida, right? Change the narrative on guns. Like faceless movements like Me Too change a narrative on like gender equity. And like in even Obama, Shepard Fairey made Obama's poster, like a random person on Twitter made Bernie's logo. Whatever, regular people can make great shit if they just are empowered to actually have their voice matter. So regular people can do that. And then also like, what if regular people could choose where they want their ad spend to go? So like, I want my money to actually be spent buying Hillary's persuasion ads in like swing states. And then what if that actually meant that like we had more money going into these states? So then the idea was like, we could build a tool that enabled people to like, someone could regularly run their ads if they wanted, but also like you could source ads and then run them out as a campaign or let other people choose to fund your ads however you want it. So anyway.
So this is so your idea is a way to democratize advertising.
Totally.
Right. Yep. And what were the initial steps that you took to kind of launch this and get it going?
Yeah. So I went to find, tried to find some coders and then I just started trying to go on it. And then, you know, I slowly started finding people. So I like got it.
Was this just you initiating or did you have partners?
Initially it was me. And then for a temporary period of time, I got my friend Zach, who was like, why don't you go with me before he went to grad school. I got him to like help me for a little bit. And then I got, this guy, Ben, who is awesome, and then he came in early and like helped start this thing, and he was like kind of does product and kind of like helping think through the tech. We got this guy Mike, who at LaunchCode led our technology, so then he left LaunchCode to come do this with us, and he's exceptional.
And is this human agency, is it for profit, non-profit, how's it structured?
So we kind of have it where it's complex. So we have human agency itself is like a corporation that we have, like, yeah, it's a corporation. And then I actually have a 501c3 and a PAC. And so then on our platform itself, the way that it's set up is that like, if people come in and they want to support, like if you want to democratize people's ability not to like, if you want to make it so people can fund something where, they're like funding, like, you know, a Democratic ad somewhere, but they're not through a candidate, then they don't really realize it, but all the funding gets automatically routed through a PAC, which then is like a donor advised PAC, or we have a donor advised nonprofit component, and whatever, there's mechanisms, but like the platform itself is built under like a C corp. And then we got like a little bit of investment. We did Higher Ground Labs, right? This is the Progressive Tech Accelerator. Those guys are great. And kind of built out this little tool. And then we were like, last summer, we were like, oh, we should test this tool we're building, see how it's going. So we came up with a bunch of different ideas to test it. And so we went to people. So we went to, and kind of like low hanging fruit. So we went to this guy, Wesley Bell. He was in St. Louis, Missouri, outside of, he was a city council member in Ferguson. And basically there was this guy, Bob McCullough. He was the prosecutor in St. Louis County. And he was essentially the guy who said like, hey, I'm not going to like press heavy charges on, the guy who killed Michael Brown. And so Wesley Bell decided to run for county prosecutor against, McCullough. McCullough had 7 times more money. When we got on the show, McCullough had 20 times more money. And basically McCullough had way more name recognition and had been prosecutor for 25 years. So we came in and we're like, hey, we'll like run your ads for you. And Bell had like, you know, was in the New York Times and stuff, but like essentially had like generally like not a ton of name ID, which is kind of key in primaries. And so we went in and we're like, who are the primary voters going to be? And it's like the unions were spending $30 million on right to work, or essentially like say voting no on right to work. So it's a thing called Prop A. And so we just ran ads to every union member in the area, trying to associate Wesley Bell with no on Prop A. And then Wesley Bell ended up winning, which was pretty nuts. And so we did like, anyway, started there, and then it was just like more and more people.
And was this, with sort of user generated ads, or were you doing the creative on them?
So on that specific one, we just took content that they had, but like we were testing all the ads and their content was coming in from users, like people in our community. And so mm-hmm. we had produced ads, and this is kind of how we operate. We now have like bits of produced ads and we have user generated stuff. And like our most effective ad with Wesley Bell was just a bunch of hashtags on a piece of paper, which was kind of cool.
And so what year is this now? When is this?
This was 2018. This was summer 2018.
Okay. So where are you now with Human Agency? What's cooking?
Yeah. Great. So yeah. So now we kind of have a number of things. Like the core things we're doing is we have like a little agency. So we, you know, kind of do a full suite collection of digital services plus with an emphasis on also kind of like user generated content stuff. And then we're also kind of we do stuff for people and also ourselves where we're kind of building tools for user generated content. So a little example would be, we have a site called Minus 45.
Called what?
Minus 45. So mm-hmm. If you look at it, like Trump's the 45th president. And like at the time we started, his popularity was at 45%. So it was like too high. Right. And our core thing was like, we live in these bubbles, echo chambers, where like, where people are just not hearing from each other. Like, how does Trump still have 45% approval rating? Like, it's too high, in part because like people are just getting bad information. So we created this project where like people who don't like Trump could make ads and messages that we would then like run out as ads to Trump supporters, and we would be testing like,
okay. And who would pay for them?
So people as well. So we've gotten like that specific.
So project. You have a funding stream for that project. You raise the money online for that, basically?
Yeah, either online or we, you know, if people want, we go to like little house parties and they'll like go to people's houses and like tell people how advertising works, and then like people fund it.
So what kind of impact do you think you're having with that? What's the scale?
I mean, I think that specific project is like still to be scaled. In terms of like
it's small yet.
I mean, but you know, like we've still probably run like, you know, we've run ads and we ran ads it right before the midterms in like a bunch of the competitive house districts. We've like, if you go to minus45.com and you click create, you could see like a ton of different ways that users can make messages. You could like upload a video. You can literally write a letter to a PO box. You can write a message online. You can also like call a phone number.
So thank you for calling Minus 45. Please leave a message for a Trump supporter and we'll make sure they hear it. Happy messaging.
And so we have a ton of messages that like you can go and all those voice messages get turned into video ads.
So one of the, you know, one of the reasons that campaigns have traditionally been very top down and sort of controlling is because they haven't always trusted random individuals to convey their message accurately, right? And there is a risk to people hijacking this process and saying things that are counterproductive. How do you think that through?
Yeah. Like, we're using the same user-generated stuff with different clients, and it's like we actually control which of those user-generated messages actually get out.
You in a kind of top-down way are weeding through this.
Totally.
Yes.
Right.
So you're filtering.
We're filtering and testing.
Got it.
And so
because there are certainly things you could have one person call a Trump supporter with something that would harden them in their position, unquestionably, right?
Totally.
Yeah. So you have to be, so how do you test the impact of this kind of user-generated content?
Yeah. I mean, there's two different ways that you can kind of like, there's probably a couple different ways you can test content. One is people could just be like, hey, we just want reactions. So like, which things get the most reaction? But that's not actually a good way to test anything other than just like, if you're within your own bubble, reactions like not a bad thing, but if you're crossing bubbles, it's not that great. So the way to like typically measure these things is like there's groups that do like, you can go to like someone like Swayable, right? I don't know if you guys know Swayable, but
I interviewed them earlier. Yes,
totally. So like they're like really good at like doing in-depth testing where they'll be like, hey, like here's 3,000 people. We show 1,000 of them white piece of paper, 2,000 like, you know, different ads and see how they behave differently.
Do you use other people's testing platforms?
So we do some stuff with like Swayable. We do some, like when we work with people, we'll do stuff with like Change Research. People all do really great work and are just awesome people. But it's also very expensive. So what we've kind of come up with is also a very, like we can test messages reasonably effectively for $2.50 each, which is pretty cool.
So it sounds like sometimes you're your own client, right? You're doing your own project, like the Trump stuff. Who are clients of Human Agency otherwise?
Yeah. So, I mean, we're working with like, you know, we did US House campaigns. We did Senate. Like we worked on some Senate stuff. We did
with them hiring us.
Yeah. We did like, there's a little group that's pretty cool that does a bunch of like effort to replace sheriffs around the country that are like racist sheriffs. So we did.
What's
like,
that group called?
It's called Trusting Sheriffs.
Okay.
It's got Max Rose runs that. We ran ads for different sheriff races. We have land trusts and nonprofits that we're working with, whatever, you know, kind of like we have ballot initiative stuff that we're doing with different folks.
Do you have more clients than you can handle, or are you searching hard for clients?
I would say we are growing. So what I mean by that is basically
right now, like, how many people working with you?
Like in our company?
Yeah.
16.
16.
We had,
and you started
one a year ago.
No, so you're up to 16.
Yeah.
And what do those people do in general?
Yeah. So, I mean, we have two pieces. So we're building our own ad platform, basically built on the Facebook, Google, and other networks that is just going to be like the simplest way to like run out ads and like source, you know, you could bring in UGC or whatever. So we're building that. So that's about half our team is just purely like engineers. And then we have half of our team that is like, agency services,
content stuff. Yeah.
And growing.
You're hiring actively.
Actively hiring for basically everything you could imagine.
am I under consideration as a result of this interview?
Yeah, for sure.
Are you talking to any of the presidential campaigns currently?
There's different ways that we're exploring working with presidential campaigns. One is we'll like generally work with any presidential, we'll like non-exclusively work with presidential campaigns around UGC. So like we can set up like
UGC being what?
User generated content, like human beings making messages. So if like,
so you're willing to give any, to work with any campaign to give them the sort of ability to do this kind of work, and you're not going to pick a particular one.
Totally.
Because you want to be a platform for this across the space.
Mm-hmm.
Is that going to be true in Democratic primaries down further down the ballot?
I mean, I think in general, if people want to do like user generated content, like human content, we'll work with like, you know, anybody.
You know, not every business decides to limit its potential clients by ideology. What thinking went into deciding who you will work with and who you won't?
Yeah. I mean, so there's kind of, we work in political space, nonprofits, and small businesses. And I mean, I think that our general take is like trying to work with clients whose goal aligns with like our fundamental values or just like advancing human agency, right? So like if you're going to like do things and if your general like approach is fitting with like actually helping humans and not like being detrimental. And so what I mean by that would be like, you know,
well, everybody thinks they're, everybody out there thinks that, every Republican thinks that, you know, every corporation thinks that.
Totally.
Exxon is helping people have more human agency by allowing them to get to gas up their car and go to work.
That's a great point. Yeah. Well, a lot of them are wrong.
so you're going to have to, you're going to have to, as a corporation, make those calls.
Yeah. I would say we make those calls and, you know, I would look at it as being like, you know, pretty clearly it's like, if you're a Republican in America today,
you're coming at this with a partisan lens.
I'm trying to,
you're trying to navigate this space in a way that fits with your conscience.
I would say, yeah, I would say I'm trying to navigate this space in a way that fits with my conscience and doing so in a way where from a who we're working with, it tends to be predominantly Democrats. But from a like perspective of like one of the big issues that we see is just the division that we have in this country, in particular people living in bubbles and echo chambers. And that like one of the unique things you can do with ads is actually break through echo chambers because they're kind of in this stupid way.
But supposing I run a brewery in St. Mm-hmm. Louis and I come to you and I say, I love what you're doing in politics. I want you to promote my brewery with these same techniques. What do you say?
I don't know. Do I like your beer?
Well, so you answered that way. So if it's Anheuser-Busch, which is not even owned here anymore,
yeah.
Do you say yes?
Yeah, probably not.
So it's, but these are, but it's a local brewery, you know, then maybe yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think that you have to like look at kind of like what it is, but.
Because something like, you know, working for Volkswagen or something could easily dwarf the practice of that you have. And you know, maybe that's good for the business and maybe it changes the business in a way that you don't want.
Yeah, totally. Maybe I'm kind of like a little utilitarian. So it's kind of like if I thought that working with someone would give us the resources to like, okay, an example would be what I think is really cool about Google or Apple is that like you kind of have democratized access to information. Like if I'm a billionaire, the best way I can search for information is like with Google and that's available to lots of people. And so I think that like the problem is like where the underlying incentives for those things like end up skewing to like manipulating people, like let's say with an ad based model is like manipulating people for like kind of in ways that they don't properly recognize or that are just not good for them. But like, I do think that to the degree that like we build a tool that because we're only willing to work with like certain people, it is like I think it could end up harming our ability to build a great tool for the people we're ultimately trying to serve. And I think the bottom line for us is just like, how are we actually making it so that what we're building is like giving people more power to decide how they want their money used in the social good space? How are we ultimately making sure that those people who have a dollar, their dollar is as impactful and as effective as someone who has $1 billion to put in? Because right now, not only does someone have $1 billion to put into politics and you've got like a dollar, but like the person who's got $1 billion, they have way more control and their money's used way more effectively than like someone who has a dollar.
Sometimes,
but like, but
yeah,
too often you have like,
but they might be hiring a firm that specializes in targeting this and like Trump did.
And your money doesn't have to, like, if your money doesn't have to go back into fundraising to like, if Bloomberg's going to put a bunch of money and he just puts it into ads and generating the result, if I donate my money to a campaign, they're going to take my money and try to use it to raise more money.
So you have this unusual experience of having started two things that have kind of taken off. And that's, you know, that's pretty rare, especially someone who I gather is probably not out of his 20s, or not out by much. What have you learned about entrepreneurship from these two examples? You know, it's certainly the case that you could have, with the same talents that you have and the same effort, have started two things that didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But why do you think you started two things that did? What was it about the direction that you came at them? Because I think there was something, there's something that you're bringing to this, which is different than what had gone before.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, there's a lot of luck, right? Because I've probably had a million ideas that I've like thought about or dabbled in that just never happened. And so part of it is just like running with the things that worked. And then I think that
part of it's in like idea generation and doing and generating a lot of ideas
and testing out those things.
So there's sort of this lean startup attitude that's baked into you.
Yeah. Some of that, some of the just like, I just think it's like field of dream style. Like if you dream it, it's possible. And if you build it, like, and it's worthwhile, people will come and want to be part of it. Like,
but somehow you pick two models. You saw a need. Right, you saw a need in the first case of a frustration with a particular situation, and you tried kind of to pull different threads together.
Yeah, I think the key thing with both of them, to some degree, is like is there's just like ultimately they play at the intersection of social good and money to some degree. Like in LaunchCode, like companies are willing to pay to hire people. And the typical model of workforce development of workforce agencies is like, we'll pay you, a company, to hire someone.
That model is out there, though. There are a bunch of nonprofits with a similar model, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
But I don't think they were sourcing people in a similar way.
But I think that those...
And they weren't doing those kind of boot camps in a similar way.
I think that by working backwards from like what a company would be willing to like what a company needs and what a company would pay for, then we solve for helping people get to the point where they actually meet what the company needs and like, and are kind of able to keep learning on their own. So a person that's like, if you teach a person how to fish versus you give them a fish or something, it's like, how do we really get someone to the point where they're like able to be like, and I fucking hate so much of capitalism, but like, how do you get somebody to the point where like they can like actually add value in like this capitalistic system.
But you're really, I mean, you may not like much about capitalism, but you're really tapping into some of the strengths of capitalism.
Totally.
When you are looking for people who are motivated and rewarding them for their motivation in a certain sense through LaunchCode, and you're looking for people with political motivation and giving them tools that will actually make the motivated people have more impact, right? Which is very incentive-based, sort of an inherently capitalist model.
Yeah. I think that,
which I don't think there's anything wrong with.
Totally. And I think that, right, there's clarity around just saying like, I think incentive-based models and pieces of capitalism are highly effective for actually driving the change that you want. And that like the benefit of like government and regulation and any of these things is just the context in which you ensure that like the systems work in ways that you believe in. And so like, you know, there's a lot of like, one thing that I think is powerful potentially in what we're doing with our ad platform is like, there's a ton of things that try to do good, but don't like on the, and maybe even have decent, they say they're trying to do good, they have decent motivations, but like they don't have a way to make money, right? Like change.org, you like refer people, but there's not a great business model behind it.
They've done all right.
Done all right. But it's like, but you know, also mostly held it float through Reid Hoffman, but like, you generally like, or like all these ad platforms that exist where people get free access, but they get free access by paying. Like, I think what's unique is like, and who knows how it'll work, but people fundamentally have to pay for ads. Like you pay for an ad. And so it gives us an inherent, like whether it's a campaign or a person, there's a financial transaction. So you don't have to have your, like how you're ultimately able to sustain and survive be some other like tangible thing other than very direct, like, hey, here's like your campaign, like here's how we help you and here's what it costs. You're a person and like here's how it works, and you can understand exactly how your money is being used, and you understand the benefit and you can understand the costs. And it's not a model in which like if it works, in theory, people are paying. So it like can sustain in that way.
So what's your vision? Where would you like to see this all end up, or, you know, go towards?
Yeah. I mean, mostly I'm just afraid of the robots. if I went down to it, so I'd be like, that's actually probably my primary motivator. And if I, then it actually motivates also a lot of these things, just like the idea of like, how do you actually reach people to try to inform them about things that are important, whether it's like technological obsolescence or it's like global warming. It's just like, to me, what we're trying to do with like democratizing advertising is really, how can we use these tools as a way to like actually inform people of critically important things that they may not know about otherwise.
Now, of course, one challenge is you build a system like this for good, someone copies it for evil.
Yeah, totally. I mean, my take would be a lot of the...
Or just what they believe to be good, which is totally in opposition to your vision.
Totally. I mean, I think that generally figuring out how to reduce division in a like, or, and build the ability to connect people who are not exactly like you is really what advertising does at like a human level. And the people who would want to use like human, like advertising that works at like a human level rather than like what already exists at like a corporate level, I think there's like a lot of the right incentives are there. But I mean, I think a true statement would be to say, I don't actually think that all the things you can do with advertising today should be illegal. And like, there's massive risk in regulation that is led by Facebook and Google, making it so that it just works like similar to like a GDPR. There's like some great things in GDPR, but there's also a lot of ways in which it just entrenched interests.
For those who don't know, GDPR?
GDPR rolled out in Europe and is basically just like a regulation framework to try to make it so that like, you know, like it has the thing which people probably heard about, which is like the right to be forgotten. So you can like make it so that you can remove, you know, some of your digital presence. And it's meant to like ensure that if you're being tracked and your data is being used, that you're consenting and you're like, you're able to access. It's meant to provide protections, but it's such a complex thing. And like, if you saw Orrin Hatch interview Mark Zuckerberg this year and be like, sir, like, when are you going to start like making money? And he's like, all right, how are you going to make money, sir? And he was like, sir, we like, our business is ads. And it was like the people who are regulating don't actually understand like,
some of them a really lot don't. Of these
things. And so there's some big risks in the regulation space, but I think, I would say like the unfettered nature of it's also super risky.
So that was a kind of philosophical answer to the question, but in a more mundane sense, in like what you would like your company to become and do over 3 to 5 years.
Yeah.
What are you thinking there?
I mean, I think we're just trying to solve individual problems that we see through advertising. So, and through both empowering people and organizations, and whether that's like, hey, we want to pass, you know, AVR around the country, automatic voter registration, or we want to do minimum wage stuff, like that requires, you know, like there's the potential to do great ballot initiative work where we're, you know, essentially bringing kind of technical capacity to those things, you know, to political campaigns, to nonprofits. There's like a ton of cool ways that we can use kind of the skills we have and the team that we're building to like actually advance the things that we care about. At the same time, to actually expand people's perspective of what's possible with forms of communications, like the Minus 45 initiative, where we're trying to enable people to actually send messages to Trump supporters. Or if you think about like, you know, if you go to our website, you can like, you lost your dog, you can like run out ads as like, be like, here's where I lost my dog. And then we'll run ads as digital flyers. Or if you think about like, we've talked with the UN Refugee Agency and like, how has someone like the UN Refugee Agency ever run ads? Like only for fundraising purposes. But if you really think about it, over half of refugees have Facebook and you know where refugee camps are, and you could basically, and it's so cheap to run an ad to a refugee, and you could be running ads that are actually like, hey, welcome to Greece for everyone who just got to like a refugee camp in Greece. And like, here is your legal resources. Here's your healthcare resources. And like, there's a lot of ways that we can actually be using these tools and like the sophisticated targeting mechanisms that have like been built up here to actually be reaching people with information that's very important to reach them with.
How could people collaborate with you if they want to, if they're intrigued by this conversation?
Yeah. I mean, I think if one is like, if you are a political campaign or initiative or someone trying to do like get someone elected or make an electoral thing happen, like basically we can do high quality work for you, both from kind of ad distribution to creative and bringing forms of creative that is really hard to get and is highly effective, as even proved out by the Move On Real Voter Voices. And then I think if you're just a person who's like, hey, like I'm a little, you know, a rich person, you're like, I'm, or a regular person even, and I like want to, like, if you're just a person and you are like
a human,
if you're a human and you just want to like actually think through how can I be empowered in some way to like do something outside the system, it's like, like we're doing stuff, whether it's you making messages or you helping fund these side initiatives to actually use like ads to solve and communication to solve social problems, to if you're like an organization that does services that we should tap into and we can be utilizing as we're working on kind of with groups, then like let's team up and let's like try to make more stuff happen and do good stuff. And we may also be doing like a bus tour this summer, going around and like trying to like doing little presentations around like how advertising works in communities around America, and like having a thing where people can send messages to other Americans, or really other people in general. And so like if you're in a town around the country and you want to either chat or you want to like host a like little like community gathering of people where we like do a cool little presentation on advertising and humanity, let us know.
Very cool. Brendan, anything else you want to say?
No, thanks for having me. Thank you.
It was enjoyable. That was Brendan Lind at Human Agency. He's at humanagency.org. I'm curious to see if Brendan's vision catches fire on the progressive side. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at resistance-dashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts